Welcome to the Focus Today podcast with Perry Atkinson.
Focus Today, I'm your host, Perry Atkinson, and I've been looking forward to talking to our guest today. John Holzman's with us. He's the author of a fascinating book called The Best Hope, A History of American Realism. He's also the president and the managing partner of John C. Holzman Enterprises. He's a prominent global political risk consulting firm. By the way, there's a picture of his book, the cover of his book on the screen there, so check that out, John Holzman. And we're delighted to have him today. He's also a senior columnist for City AM newspaper in London. He's a regular columnist for the Arab News, The Hill in Washington, The Aspen in Rome, and various outlets in New Delhi. I have no idea when John sleeps, but we are delighted that we have him. John, good to see you. How are you, friend?
thank you, Perry, for that shameless introduction, and I wish there were two of me as well.
Thank you. Where are you? Where are we getting you from?
I'm in Milan, Italy right now. You're the last thing in a day, and then I'm hoping to have a glass of Prosecco and some pasta.
Alfredo or red sauce?
I think definitely Alfredo today.
Okay, good to see you. Thanks for your time. Thanks for staying up for us. Okay, well, this is so much to talk about here. The Last Hope. What are you trying to tell us here, Coach?
What I'm trying to tell you is that this is a moment of opportunity, that we talk about doom and gloom all the time, particularly in my Republican Party. But the neoconservatives being kind of shown the door by Donald Trump and others is actually an opportunity to go back to what worked for our country for about 180 years, and that's American realism. If you look at anyone from George Washington and Alexander Hamilton, all the way through to the Kennedys dealing with the Cuban Missile Crisis, you see realism. An American foreign policy fit for Americans was the key. It's only when we go away from this that we go wrong. And so, to quote the Beatles, it's time we get back to what worked. And this book is a call for the GOP to get back to a foreign policy based on American national interests, rather than worrying about a bunch of European bureaucrats and what they might think.
Well said. So let me ask you to define American realism.
Realism would be looking at the things that buttress the American nation, that make the American nation work. And it's a very simple yardstick to view everything. If doing something abroad furthers the interests of real Americans, we ought to consider doing that, whether it's diplomatically, economically, or even on that rare occasion, militarily. But we start with what works for the American people, remembering that we have a $32 trillion deficit, an opioid crisis, an education crisis, an infrastructure crisis. Do you have to convince me that doing something abroad furthers the actual lives and interests of Americans as they live their lives, and not the interests of people at the Council on Foreign Relations, where I happen to be a life member? But I can tell you they don't think that way, Perry.
So, John, I'm a former Chase Stearman for the GOP. I have a son who's been a GOP legislator for 14 years in our state. And I have to tell you, after managing the party for 4 years, the greatest challenge I had was managing the Republicans to stay civil among themselves. I'd rather have a root canal. We're fighting ourselves. We're not fighting the enemy. What's going on here, Coach?
No, you're exactly right. And that's what this book is about. This is a rally round the flag book. This is to say, we have a chapter on Washington getting through the Jay Treaty. The beginning, the last best hope, the quote comes from Lincoln, saying everything must be seen through the present and future of America. We have to look at the things that bind us together. The two wings of the Republican Party that are left if the neocons are shown the door are the Jacksonian base of the party and Jeffersonians like myself, who have a more elitist view, whereas the Jacksonians form the base of the party. A good dividing line between the two is, I'm a Jeffersonian, I like Johnny Cash. Jacksonians are Johnny Cash. There's a difference. But we all agree on a couple basic things. We are suspicious of centralized government. We believe in American liberty and freedom. We believe in local government, accountable government, limited government, freedom, the Constitution, the Bill of Rights, and the people of our country. And if you start there, you suddenly find this realist glue that draws together the Jeffersonians and the Jacksonians, so we don't end up like cats fighting in a bag.
So Can this big government be put back in the bag?
Part of the key to this is foreign policy, and you're getting at this the other way, which is right. If you are for fighting wars everywhere all the time, all at once, you're going to have big government. You have to. You have to tax incredibly. You have to have a huge national security state. You have to have largely unaccountable government in Washington. That's not what Jeffersonians and Jacksonians and the base of the Republican Party are about or for. If you have limited government where you divide interests between primary American interests, the stuff we absolutely have to do, like deal with China in the Indo-Pacific, secondary interests, which are important and on a good day we'll deal with, but aren't vital, and tertiary interests where we don't really have to play, suddenly you're for limited government. The two go together.
Let me come off the freeway just for a moment, John, and ask you a question about the current administration. How would you describe the current administration's ideology based upon what we're trying to solve among ourselves?
They're Wilsonians, and the problem with this old Democratic Party tradition is it believes in things that aren't real. It believes in the international community. I've been to many NATO meetings here in Europe. And let me tell you, there is no international community. There are great powers in NATO who sometimes work together. The United States, first and foremost, France, Britain, to a lesser extent, Spain and Italy, Poland and Germany. There is no international community. It's made up of states. Thank goodness we don't have world government. But they talk as though there's this further international community. And what this really is a way for other people to use our army. As I said to Chancellor Schroeder of Germany, when you talk about weed, is this a chance for you to reach into my pocket, pick my pocket, and use my army or not? Because I won't let you do that. That's for the American national interest, not yours. I don't blame you for trying. I blame people like Joe Biden for allowing that to happen.
How do you explain the damage of the sociological destruction of our country?
Part of it is that we don't look at the things that really matter. And so young people, I was listening to your last segment on Hollywood, young people are adrift. If you don't believe in four or five basic things, and there's a very famous lecture given by a guy named Isaiah Berlin about Winston Churchill. And the lecture goes, it talks about the fox and the hedgehog. Mm. The fox knows many things, but the hedgehog knows one big thing. Churchill was wrong about all kinds of things for 50 years. In fact, the majority of things he weighed into with a great deal of enthusiasm, he was wrong about, but he was right about one big thing, the evil of Nazism, the peril that posed to Western civilization. And about that one big thing, he wouldn't give way. We have to go back to the things that matter. And let me tell you, as somebody who's lived abroad for 25 years now, that the United States is still an exceptional country. As Reagan put it, a shining city on a hill. But to maintain that position as a shining city on a hill, we have to take care of that example. It is not inevitable that everyone will see America as a wonderful place. We have real problems that we have to deal with, and that means we don't fight wars of choice like Iraq that cost $1 trillion, leave Iran the dominant power in the Gulf, lead to the spread of ISIS, and then we look at each other, blink, and say we tried. We say, is that $1 trillion better spent making us an example for the rest of the world or intervening in a conflict that is really only of peripheral interest the United States? That's where foreign policy and domestic policy meet.
So you in that last sentence, John, you kind of have described the hypocrisy of the left, where they're anti-war, their policies have created it.
No, exactly. The only Donald Trump, for all the bluster and the bluff and the talk, is the only modern president in the post-Cold War era who did not start a war. It's extraordinary. I mean, when I just mention it in Washington, they literally hiss at me, the Democrats. I will run a list of failure. Somalia, Haiti, Bosnia, Kosovo, Afghanistan, Iraq. They've cost trillions of dollars, hundreds of thousands of lives in total, and not one of those interventions has left the United States better off than it was before. And the biggest laugh line I get when I do my book tour at the moment about Iraq is simply, do you want your $1 trillion back? And everybody says, yes, of course we do. The things we could do with that, give it back to our hardworking people, deal with the opioid crisis, deal with our infrastructure, deal with our education. It's not that you don't do anything. It's that you pick and choose the things that suit our people. The hypocrisy of the Democrats is to talk about peace while not a single Democratic president since the end of the Cold War has not engaged in war.
Do you think the, how can I explain this? Do you think that the traditional Democrat is waking up to this?
I think some are. You know, as I joke in the book, I mean, we have heroes of both parties. Franklin Roosevelt, getting us ready to fight World War II, did a magisterial job. He's one of the heroes of the book. He came up with an idea of when you intervene, the Roosevelt rule, as we call it in the book, and when you don't, which is pretty important. Harry Truman, in starting the Marshall Plan and leading us to victory in the Cold War, is a hero, along with Jack Kennedy. Richard Nixon's in the book, Ronald Reagan. The book is not party political. There are heroes across the spectrum. But that old, tough, traditional, Democratic, hawkish side that agreed, Truman and Eisenhower agreeing on how to deal with Stalin, those days are over when 25%, the base of the party, is gone woke, as you were mentioning in the last segment. And part of being woke is this progressive view that we have to put American power at the service of a world community, of world interests. That doesn't work. It's not world interests that pay for our army. It's not the blood and treasure of the rest of the world. It's our blood and treasure, which is sacred and precious and should only be expended when specific American interests are to play for. So their entire philosophy is wrong at the moment. But yes, there is an old tradition going back to FDR, Truman, Jack Kennedy, that's just waiting to be there. And I'm with Reagan. I'm all for addition and not subtraction. When the Democrats do the right thing in foreign policy, we should work with them. When they don't, as they are now, we should call them out. But we should be prepared to work with them based upon American national interests.
That's beautifully said. So do you think that I'm watching this election like everybody else, like you, and the numbers are kind of staggering. You kind of wonder, is America waking up to wokeism?
Yes, they've overreached like Robespierre has always do. And the French Revolution, a subject, you know, again, my political risk firm, we're all historians because unlike the theory, the theoretical approach of political scientists, I'm interested in the lived history of the past 3,000 years, how humans have actually lived, the good things they've done, the bad things they've done, and the famous adage that history, if it doesn't repeat itself, at least it rhymes. There are patterns there to be learned from. And this book is about the American patterns organically that have led us to success and a plea to go back to those patterns. But yes, the woke people imagine human beings being something that they're not, that they have no spiritual needs, that they have no nationalistic needs, that they don't need to be grounded in community, local community, love of country, love of family, the desire aspirationally to get ahead through hard work and capitalism. The reason I got to know Lady Thatcher late in her life, which was a wonderful thing. And as she once said to me, John, the reason socialism will not work is that eventually they run out of other people's money to spend.
Right.
And this is a human reality. Our belief and what we believe in as conservatives simply works better. We're not perfect, goodness knows, but it works better, and it's more the way human beings have lived in history than this fantasy woke view that isn't like anybody that I know.
Has America lost its virtue, and can it get it back?
To some extent, I think it has, and this book is an optimistic effort to get it back, to say to ourselves, we stand on the shoulders of giants. We've inherited the biggest, most vibrant economy of the world, the central place in that world where we actually have agency in determining what happens. And we should be grateful to those who came before us and used realism to put us where we are. Have we strayed away from that? I would argue yes. But in the neocons leaving the party, I think there's a chance for those who are Johnny Cash and for those who like Johnny Cash, the Jeffersonians and the Jacksonians, to get back to the virtue that defined our republic and has taken us this long way. And so I have an optimistic view. Everything is to fight for under heaven and earth.
Wow. Got a few more questions for you. Let me take a quick break. Viewers and listeners, check out John's book. It's called The Last Best Hope, A History of American Realism. There is a picture of the cover of John's book on the screen. He does have a website, johnholzman.substack.com. And we'll take a Boy Named Sue break. We'll be right back.
We'll be back to this week's interview in just a few seconds. In the meantime, we want to let you know that you can watch this interview, plus many more exclusive interviews that happen this week on the Dove's Daily TV and radio show by visiting our website, thedove.us. And while you're there, sign up for our free daily devotional, The Word for You Today. 3 months of daily readings that will connect you with God's Word. Now, back to the show.
Welcome back. What an honor to have with us today. John Holzman is the author of a fascinating book called The Last Best Hope, A History of American Realism. There's a picture of the cover of the book on the screen. You may want to check it out, get it online. The Last Best Hope, History of America's Realism. He also has a website, John Holzman, HULSMAN.substack.com. And there's a picture of his landing page. We're Skyping him in from Italy today, and we're keeping him from his pasta dinner. We'll get him to that in just a moment. Alfredo sauce. You're the man. That's good stuff. All right. John, where does the Judeo-Christian faith community weigh in on American realism?
I think you start by saying that the Judeo-Christian community has something incredibly valuable, fundamental, and worth protecting. And let me put it this way. There's a line in the book that I love. We're too ashamed to talk about our values in foreign policy. We leave that to the Democrats too often. And I remember a quote from Eisenhower. He's listening to the barbarity of Mao and others. And he says to himself, in the real world, the United States should be a lot prouder about what it is and the things it believes in terms of our Christian and Judeo-Christian beliefs, because the alternatives to the United States in the 20th century have been so awful. The people who can run the world, if you're sitting anywhere from the safety of a French cafe, are the Kaiser, the Japanese militarists, Hitler, Stalin, Mao, or the bumbling old United States. And as we're not Charles Manson or Ted Bundy of international relations, we should be a lot prouder of what we are, that on the worst day, making our worst mistakes, we believe and care about the things that matter. And we should say that. And Ronald Reagan, there's a great chapter in the book on Reagan, in his sunny, underestimated way, knew this. And when he made his speech about the wall, we talk about it, that everyone told him not to make the speech. The German left-wing press, and I've lived in Berlin, is laughing at him as a naive amateur. The State Department say you're just going to alienate Gorbachev. And he goes and he talks to dissidents who'd lived in East Germany, and it turns out they wanted to hear about American faith, America's chance for freedom of religion, the chance to worship God in your own way. But this was a strength, and this gave Reagan the strength to give what is now seen as one of the seminal speeches of the Cold War. So we shouldn't be shy about the things we believe and the things that are worth protecting. That doesn't make us naive, as Reagan shows, that makes us strong.
I think you just gave one of the best sermons, a stand up for what you believe, I've heard in a long time. Thank you. Well said. So I want to come over to what's happening in Israel and America's involvement, support, or two-faced position. What's your 30,000-foot view?
I know a lot about American domestic politics, unfortunately, and Joe Biden, in trying to be overly clever, will end up alienating everybody. Because at first he was strongly with Israel, and then he looked at the polling numbers in Michigan, where there's an Arab American community very angry with him, as well as the woke, progressive, center-left base of his party, say 25% of his party, particularly younger people, who don't know when they're chanting about the river and the sea, which river and which sea they're actually talking about, but they nonetheless believe this fervently. And so Biden then starts pressuring Israel not to go in and avenge the tragedy, the terrorist attacks of early October in Israel, which were horrendous, barbaric attacks. And rather than letting them avenge this, Biden's telling them now to pull back, thereby alienating everybody. The people in the beginning who wanted him to be strong allies of Israel now see him pulling back to save his own skin. And so that's no good. And on the other hand, the left of his party are not going to forgive him for not going along with Hamas, incredibly, in the first place. And so what I see is America, Biden using short-term political gains, again, not to look at both the practical and the moral case here. Israel has every right to defend itself. We should be involved in supporting them in doing so and then planning for the day after Rafah, when that place is going to have to be governed, and that's a hornet's nest, and diplomatically helping prepare for that. But probably because Biden has been led by the nose through domestic politics, he's ended up alienating literally everyone.
Do you expect Israel to go at it alone, even without the support of the United States, to finish the job?
Yes. Oh, I do. I mean, there's a country, and I've worked with Israel for a long time, that has a very pronounced sense of its own national interests. And they may take a break for this possible hostage deal But there's no doubt at the end of that that Bibi Netanyahu will go right back to Rafah. For one thing, he has his own domestic political concerns, which are about finishing the job there. And so, yes, I mean, nothing that the United States says, that any sort of efforts that Biden has made to try to put the brakes on have failed, for the simple reason that Israel is going to do what Israel feels it needs to do for its own citizens. And America, although important, is a secondary concern for them. So, no, all that's happening is that we're alienating a close and valued ally.
Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, who had his own domestic problems, and then this thing broke out on October 7th, and this did break out under his watch. Do you think in time he's held accountable for that?
Absolutely, and that's a great question, Perry, that Israeli political culture is very clear. The ultimate goal of an Israeli prime minister is to guard the state from surprise attack. This has happened to Israel before, and even giants of Israel, Moshe Dayan, the greatest military genius they've ever had, and they've had a number of them, was removed as defense minister after the Yom Kippur War about a year and a half later because this surprise attack got the better of him. Golda Meir, who was regarded as a very tough and effective prime minister, likewise was removed about a year and a half later because of her inability to do this. Olmert in Lebanon was removed. Begin in Lebanon was removed. And Netanyahu, too, a year and a half in, for all that he's tactically the Harry Houdini of Israeli politics, he also will be removed because this did happen on his watch. And then you look for someone like Benny Gantz, the centrist in the war cabinet, another former general who ran the Israeli army. Gantz is probably the most likely guy to take over after Netanyahu in, say, 18 to 24 months.
Okay. Back to our hometown for a little bit. Does Trump win, you think?
Oh, yeah. I mean, the idea that people in Europe, and of course, we have a phrase in my profession, Perry, it's called wish casting. It's when you let what you want get in the way of what you see is going to happen. I was against the Iraq War, rightly so. I knew that even being against it, I would lose my job if I went on a limb and be against it. I knew it would fail. I knew it would cost $1 trillion. I knew it would leave Iran a dominant power in the Gulf. And I had a Thomas More moment. I had to be a man for all seasons and decide, was I going to be true to myself? But I never doubted that these things would happen. Europeans and the mainstream media on our coast are so desperate for Donald Trump to lose that they can't read polling numbers. In Emerson, the Hill poll that just came out yesterday, Trump is ahead in five of the six swing states, and he's tied in the last one, which is Pennsylvania. At the moment, if there were the election this morning, he'd win somewhere over 300 electoral votes, rather a comfortable victory. Biden's approval rating is teetering at the edge of irrelevance, which is about 40%. He's at about 41 in the Real Clear Politics average. On every major issue, Biden is losing to Trump by double digits, be it prices and the cost of living crisis, inflation, how to handle things like the border, how to deal internationally with the rest of the world, decisive leadership. Biden is in a world of hurt, and that's why you see the panic of people talking about trying to get rid of him as his cognitive faculties are even called into question. So Donald Trump is the overwhelming favorite by, say, in our firm, we put it at about 70-30.
If he's reelected, do you think he tells Davos and the WHO to take a hike?
Yes, I do. One of the things that I'm close, I mean, the people around Trump are advocating a much more realist policy, so they're natural allies of mine. And one of the things that they all say is that they're going to do a much better job staffing this time than they did last time. Last time, because they were new to the game, as is every new White House that comes to town, they often are subsumed by the establishment, and they put in power people who don't really have their interests at heart. That's not going to happen this time. You have organizations like the Heritage Foundation coming up with a list of names of good realists. You have people in the Koch Foundation who are not with Nikki Haley, I might add, coming up with names as to who might go in. And so you're going to get a much more professional, a much more realist group that tells Davos and the rest of the European bureaucrats to go take a hike. Of that, I'm certain. And that's good news indeed.
How do you think President Trump will handle China if he's reelected?
I think President Trump, partly because of his own bluster, doesn't historically get credit for the things that he should. One of them is that he's the one who saw, back when people weren't talking about it, that China is the only peer, competitor, superpower, rival we have. It's the only great power rival to the United States. Everything else is noise. Russia is an aging gas station with nuclear weapons. It's a declining regional power with huge demographic problems, an economy the size of the state of Texas, massive corruption. It's a power, but a declining, dangerous one. The only peer competitor we need to worry about is China. And Trump was the one who got really both parties to see that. And so I think you're going to see more of the same, a much tougher line economically as we do more friendshoring, we do more trade within an alliance system with countries like Japan, South Korea, India, the coming superpower, which wants to do more and more with the United States. We build up an alliance system out there to deter China from making a grab at Taiwan. I have no doubt that the Trump people and those around them, people like Elbridge Colby, a good friend of mine who's been waving his arms about China as long as I can remember, that better days are ahead for dealing with this great problem.
John, you're absolutely fascinating. I want to get you back, but I also want to honor the fact that you're late at night over there. Let me say to our viewers and listeners, check out his book called The Last Best Hope, A History of American Realism. There's a picture of the cover of the book. I think this is not only a book you will read, I think you'll end up writing in the margins. It's a real, real resource. The Last Best Hope by John Holtzman. Thank you, friend. Can we get you back?
You certainly can, Perry, anytime. I enjoyed it a lot, and next time I'll bring the Alfredo with me.
You're the man. Thanks, buddy. Have a great day.
You too. Take care.
Thank you for listening to this week's Focus Today podcast. Remember, you can visit our website to check out all the interviews we did this week on our daily Focus Today TV show at thedove.us. And if you like this podcast, please take a moment to rate us and share it with your friends.